I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. What does it take to feel like a decent human being while fighting a war? While U.S. soldiers deployed in Iraq understand they may be forced to take lives or to sacrifice their own, the reality is that even those who survive the experience physically rarely return emotionally unscathed. In January of 2007, President George W. Bush announced a plan to commit an additional 20,000 U.S. troops to the war in Iraq. Soon after, journalist David Finkel spent 8 months living among the men and women of Army Battalion 216, based out of Fort Riley, Kansas. The unit was deployed in eastern Baghdad for 15 months, during which 14 soldiers were fatally wounded and another 75 awarded Purple Hearts. Pulitzer Prize winner David Finkel is National Enterprise Editor for The Washington Post. His new book is called The Good Soldiers. David, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris.
How specifically did you get embedded with the 216?
I work for The Washington Post, and I was sent originally to do a newspaper story on the next group of soldiers heading into this new thing called the Surge. I went to Fort Riley, Kansas. I met a lieutenant colonel named Ralph Koslerich, who was about to lead 800 soldiers, young soldiers, into the Surge. And after the newspaper piece appeared, I got in touch with Koslerich, said I was interested in expanding the story into a book. And that led to an exchange of two promises that resulted in the book. My promise to him was that I had no agenda in mind. I wasn't there to write a polemic in any way. Or a first-person book. I was simply, my interest was in chronicling his corner of the war, which is what is it like, what does it feel like to be a soldier in this thing called the Surge? And he said, if you can stick to your promise, come on over. I'll give you full access to everything we do. And he was good to his word. So off I went.
So you made those promises to him. He obviously made sort of an implicit promise to you that you would be protected there. Did it take a while for you to trust that you'd be okay?
Well, that's an interesting question. He didn't promise to protect me necessarily. I think another way to answer that is to say that it took a good bit of time to earn the trust of the soldiers. They, I think for the most part, even though the command structure had okayed my being part of this battalion for the full length of their deployment, the soldiers weren't quite sure what to make of a journalist in their midst taking notes on everything they were doing. And as the months went by, and I stuck it out, and as bad things began happening to this infantry battalion, and I was present for these things, and I reacted in a way that I didn't become a problem for the soldiers, but I kept doing my job, I think slowly trust developed. And by the end of it, soldiers, I'm happy to say, were seeking me out to confide in me about how they had been transformed by this experience.
What was eastern Baghdad like in early 2007?
Well, there must be a polite way to describe this on the radio. It was a hellish place, and by the luck of the draw, the area this battalion went to, right outside Sadr City, kind of a crescent-shaped area on the eastern edge of the city. Pockets were okay, but for the most part, there hadn't been much of a military calming presence. And it was a bit out of control. Nonetheless, the soldiers went to this place full of optimism for their mission, kind of a naive optimism, I think they'd say now. And as the weeks went by, and then bombs began going off, and then the bombs became a little better targeted, and they suffered their first KIA, and then their second, and then they began being wounded in all kinds of ways. Well, of course, their feelings changed. But it was a... it was a difficult, vicious place, and again, by the luck of the draw, that's what they got for this war.
We really get that sense of the chaos that they experienced in that they get there and they have to sort of figure out a place on their own to set up their command operating post, and mm-hmm. they're just essentially looking around for an abandoned building that might do.
In the beginning, yes. They went to something called a forward operating base on the eastern side, which had a couple of battalions on it. It was not a very popular place. No congressional delegations went there. No journalists went there. You got in there, and you were behind blast walls. There were occasional rocket and mortar attacks. But part of the counterinsurgency strategy that was the underpinning of the Surge was to go out into neighborhoods and establish a presence. I think the theory of counterinsurgency at its most general is if you can make the population feel safe, then everything else will fall into place, will trickle out from there. So they would try to set up these command outposts in various neighborhoods. And I guess the thinking behind them is you just set up a building and maybe people stop by for tea. That wasn't the case. They were also surrounded by blast walls, barbed wire, gun nests on the top, very active defensive perimeter, a lot of rocketing and mortaring. And these, they would find abandoned buildings and do what they could to set up there.
Now, Coslerich comes across as just a relentlessly optimistic guy. Almost at times, he you mentioned naive optimism. He almost seems not to understand what's going on.
Oh, I think he had a great understanding of what was going on. I also think that as a commander, you don't really want to let on about the complications in your thinking. Nonetheless, relentless is a good word. Sometimes it was preposterously optimistic, but it translated well to his soldiers, especially the younger ones who, I mean, imagine this. You're 19 years old. This is your first war. It's your first deployment. It's your first time out of the country.
First time away from home for some
and
of them.
First time away from home. And one day you're in the middle of Kansas, and the next day after a long plane ride, you're being dumped into this place that that day by day, week by week, makes less and less sense. So to have a guy atop who, no matter what went on, would find some reason to say it's all good, that was kind of a mantra of his. It was almost like a nervous tic. Some guys were annoyed by this, but others were quite buoyed by it.
Were they adequately prepared for what they were to face?
They seemed like a very well-trained battalion. Nonetheless, who could really prepare for what they came up against? It's maybe the guys who had been over there a couple of times for other deployments had a sense of what might be in store for them. But even those guys couldn't believe what they were facing. Back home, the surge might have seemed like a steady progression, but over there it was exactly the opposite. It was a descent. And if the book attempts to do anything, it's not so much to write a history of the war, but it's to use the war to write an intimate portrait of young men in this time, in this place, to convey how it felt to be them. And how it felt to be them, again, speaking broadly, was to see a transformation from naivety into some kind of bitter knowledge, and in many ways, a real degradation of spirit. Not that they became bad soldiers, but at some point, when every day you're just surrounded by people trying to blow you up, and it's an enemy and a fight that becomes more diffuse and makes less sense, then the consequences are I guess, predictable and inevitable.
There's an interesting sort of dichotomy. They're still questioning why people hate them and want to kill them, and they've got this, you know, storeroom full of soccer balls and candy and pencils and things to give out mm-hmm. to the people there in Baghdad.
Right. At first, I think the idea was to shove soccer balls out and pencils out and do all the little things you're supposed to do, and by the end, the soccer balls were gathering dust in offices and the pencils weren't being given out. It's just, again, there's nothing surprising here. War, we know this, war is not a normal good thing to be in the middle of. But in this war, the details of this particular time, I think, do matter. And what happened to these men who 2 years later continue to fight the war, even though they've moved on to other things or gotten out of the army, it's important. The war is now leaving Iraq, but we're seeing more and more evidence that's now beginning to seep into American communities and into our social fabric.
How did things change for these guys even after that first soldier was killed? I shouldn't say even, but they saw many deaths during the time they were.
Well, the guys pretty much thought that they were the very best, and the reason other people were getting injured from other battalions or dying was because of some mistake that was made along the way. And if you did everything right, you were going to come out of it victorious and unscathed. And then one day when they were doing everything right, a bomb went into a Humvee and they had a dead soldier. And then came another and then came another. And even though they realized they were doing things as well as they could, they weren't going to be able to outrun and outrace all of the bombs that were in East Baghdad waiting for them to come by.
What chances, David, are there for them to grieve a fallen comrade when they're still there?
Hmm. That's an interesting question. There's a formal ceremony after. Well, there are a couple of levels of this. When someone dies, his remains are taken and prepared for shipment back home, and all this happens even before anyone's notified back in the States. When the remains are sent off in a helicopter, as many people as possible will show out in the formation, salute, pray, watch the helicopter leave. And so that's very quick, often within 6 hours, definitely within 24 hours. And that's the first reaction. And then as soon as a general officer can be found to be flown into where I was, Fab Rustamaya, to take his place in the chapel, and sometimes it would be a couple of days, sometimes it might take 10 days as the body count kept mounting, then there would be something called a memorial ceremony, which is it was quite upsetting. At first I thought guys were upset because it was just such a sad thing. But it turned out over time the sadness was supplanted by a kind of anger that the mission made less sense, and that every time there was a death, the guys closest to the dead soldier would be given seats somewhere on the right-hand side, a few rows back. And then at the very end, in would come this delegation of general officers and colonels and this and that to take the front rows, and everyone would have to sort of wait for the military brass to take its seat. Now, you can argue this makes perfect sense and it's a sign of respect, but to soldiers who were so wounded by what had just happened to them, anything in those first moments that could increase their anger, I think they were pretty quick to seize on.
What worked for them to sort of get through that anger and that grief and that pain and that fear so that they could get up the next morning and do it again?
Yeah, for some guys, it was just fistfuls of Ambien so they could get to sleep. Some guys, the Ambien didn't quite do it, so they would just spend the night walking in circles. Smoking, you weren't allowed to drink, so the ones who didn't find a way around that would just go to hookah bars on the fob and play cards all night. What finally got them back into the game was getting back into the game. Once the memorial ceremony took place, and they were allowed to leave the FOB and go back into the rotation of making patrols and doing their missions and basically endangering themselves again, then the whirl of all that seemed to take one death away. Maybe it's because as one death would recede as they moved toward the next one, if that's not too grim a way to describe it.
Was it an adrenaline thing?
I think for some of the guys, sure, there is an adrenaline rush to war. There was one great soldier. There was a guy named Adam Schumann. The book is built on characters, mm-hmm. and one of the very best ones was a sergeant named Adam Schumann.
Let me have you stop there. We're going to take a quick break, and you can tell us his story
in just
a moment.
Thank you.
David Finkel is with us. He is National Enterprise Editor for The Washington Post. His new book is called The Good Soldiers. Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Finkel, National Enterprise Editor for The Washington Post and author of the new book, The Good Soldiers. Before the break, David, you were starting to tell us about Adam Schumann, Staff Sergeant. This is a guy who did three tours?
Right, yes. Chris, he was a guy, and on the first tour, you were asking about adrenaline. He said, you know, being in a firefight was the sexiest feeling in the world. That's how he felt after tour number one. I met him in the midst of his third deployment. He had been in Iraq for about 1,000 days at that point. And the first time I met him was soon into the deployment. These guys were out on a mission, and there was a guy named Michael Emery who was up on a rooftop, and he was shot in the back of the head by a sniper. Very, very critical injury. And Emery collapsed on the roof, and they had to get him down three flights of stairs somehow so he could be medevaced out. And in the end, Adam Schumann just picked Emery up. Emery's a big guy. Threw him across his back in kind of a modified fireman's carry and started taking him down the steps. And it just so happened, because of the angle of things, much of the blood coming out of Michael Emery's head kept going into Adam Schumann's mouth, and he spit it out as he carried this guy down to be medevaced out. 6 months later, in October now, 2007, Adam Schumann was still tasting Michael Emery's blood every day and had reached the point where it wasn't sexy to be in a firefight anymore. He couldn't do it. And this is not a malingerer or a faker in any way. He was an acknowledged great soldier, severe PTSD, who had to go home. I remember the day he left, going with him to the helicopters, the line for the helicopters to get him out of there. And there were maybe six guys in line, and he joined the line. The helicopters came in, terrific racket, clatter, dust, the rest of it. Everyone moves forward to get on the helicopters. And when Schumann got to the front of the line, a hand came out, stopped him, and somebody yelled, "This isn't your helicopter." And Schumann didn't know what it meant. Hmm. Everyone else left. The helicopters left. It's just Adam Schumann now, after 1,000-some days in Baghdad. This is how he leaves. Another helicopter comes in for him, this one with the Red Cross on its side. And this is when Adam thought, you know, this is the helicopter for the wounded and the dead, and that's who I am. I'm both of those things, and that's how he left the war. So I talk to Adam from time to time. I'm in touch with a lot of the guys still. Adam is back home in Kansas, lives on the edge of a wheat field. One day he's calling me because he's so happy his wife just gave birth to a baby boy. Another day he's calling me in tears, thinking of killing himself and doesn't know what to do. So, you know, for a lot of these guys, Adam is kind of an extreme example. But as I said earlier, the war goes on.
You mentioned earlier that some of them will, you know, take Ambien to fall asleep, and there are other medications available. What kind of mental health care is there for them when they're struggling in the field but are not ill enough to leave the conflict?
If you are injured and it's a physical injury and you've lost a leg or an arm, there's no questioning anything. It's clearly there's a serious injury, and everyone in this odd way respects you for what you've been through. Mental injuries are more suspect, and there was some treatment there, the base I was on. There was a psychologist helper who was there most of the time. There was kind of a roving psychiatrist who would come in now and then and basically talk a little bit but dispense drugs. But, you know, for the most part, if you were suffering the effects of combat, they needed a fighting force. And the first intent was to see how serious you were and then get you right back out there, because they needed the platoon. They needed the Humvees filled up and the missions to continue.
How did Kozlerich try and monitor the well-being of his troops?
The same way he would monitor himself. He would just assume that everybody was fine until there was overwhelming evidence that somebody wasn't fine. And then, in the case of Adam Schumann, he couldn't have been more compassionate. In the case of some other guys who said that they were feeling the effects of this, feeling suicidal in some cases, or just complaining of other symptoms such as headaches that wouldn't go away or the rest of it. He demanded a pretty high standard of proof, and that proof wasn't always there.
The average age of the force there was 19 in this particular battalion. How often did they seem like the teenagers that they were?
Well, let me take a minute to explain one more thing about this part of Baghdad, if I can. The weapon of choice in this particular part of Baghdad, it wasn't a suicide bomber. There were firefights, but that wasn't the main threat. It was a particular type of roadside bomb called an EFP. That stands for Explosively Formed Penetrator, which sounds, it's a rather benign moniker for a horrible device. Probably cost $100 to make by military estimates. And it was so simple. It was just a tube filled with explosives. And one end, there might be a wire coming out of it that would lead to some shadow where a guy was standing with the trigger. He would trigger it either by pressing a button or remote control through using a cell phone.
And this can shred a Humvee.
Well, the other end had a copper disc on it about the size of a dinner plate. And when the button was pushed, this guy would stand in the shadows and wait for a convoy to reach the right place. He'd hit the trigger, the explosives would explode, and this copper disc would take off. And it would take off at such a high rate of speed that it would become immediately semi-molten. It would almost have a tadpole liquidy shape to it, if that makes sense. The effect of that was it would burn through whatever was in front of it. If it was a $200,000 Humvee with the thickest armored door made at that point to protect soldiers, it would just burn right through that door, and then it would burn through whatever was inside, including the soldiers. So what made this even more insidious is how many of them there were and how easily they were hidden. They were hidden in animal carcasses. They were disguised as pieces of wall, roadway curbing. They were hidden in piles of trash, and piles of trash were everywhere in Baghdad, I can tell you that. So you would see these soldiers, these 19-year-old kids, now 20 as the thing went on, oh my gosh, making the most heartbreaking daily calculations as they would go out on another mission. They would get in a Humvee and they would sit with one foot in front of the other, and their thinking was, if this main charge of an EFP comes through, I'm going to lose 1 foot. I'm not going to lose 2 feet. Or they would lean away from the door, or they would tie horseshoes to the front grill of the Humvee, whatever they could. Just these small, they would joke about last words, in the most vulgar, hysterical, profane ways. But nonetheless, out they would go every day into the streets of East Baghdad to try to pull off this coin strategy. And they had no break. They kept going, and the bombs kept coming. And it was quite something to see.
You write here about the birthday of one of the soldiers, and he was turning 21, which is, sort of a big deal in this country. And you write that to hear everybody sort of seemed okay, to hear them laughing. It sounded like laughter. Mm-hmm. And to look at their faces, you could tell something was off.
Yeah, this was a great kid named Jay March. And right before he turned 21, he was out in a convoy. He was the third in line. The second Humvee ran over some buried explosives. Guy hit the trigger. And right before Jay March turned 21, he had the experience of running up to a Humvee on fire and watching one of his closest friends burning to death in the driver's seat. The guys after that, they went back to this FOB. And that's when I really saw a long week of ambient, of guys walking around, just guys really coming to terms with it, including Jay March, who basically spent his 21st birthday under a tree just talking over and over about what it was like, what happened after that Humvee burned and he watched his friend die, which is that he found a wire, a buried wire, and he and some other guys went running into a stand of trees, following the wire, which had been wrapped around trees, and then through the trees to a house that it led to. And as they got closer, some guys come running out of the house. They go into another house. Jay March and another soldier go into this house, and they go into a back room, and there's this guy cowering, and then he turns to them and with a rifle and begins, he's about to fire. And Jay March shot. He fired. He shot. He saw. He says he saw this. He saw the bullet go into the top of the man's head. He saw the man fall. He looked to his right behind a refrigerator in the room, and there was a little girl the age of his sister who had just watched this and now was looking at him like he was about to kill her. And so Jay March, yes, not only was he 21, but he spent that birthday. It was almost like a slideshow in his head that he couldn't get control of. It was just picture after picture after picture. His friend on fire, running into the palm trees, finding this house, shooting a guy in the head, seeing the bullet going in, seeing the man fall, seeing the little girl watching, hearing her scream. Back to the beginning, again and again and again.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. David Finkel is with us. His new book is called The Good Soldiers. Let's go first on the line to Sween in Plano. Hi, Sween.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Hi, David. My question is right behind that experience you told about the soldier Jay. What's the soldiers feeling about the impact they're having on the people of Iraq?
Well, you know, that's I'm glad you asked that question. One of the difficult things about reporting this book, unlike other foreign assignments I've had, was being able to range around freely enough to get at a fuller answer of what you're asking. Even at the beginning of the war, I was there for the Washington Post, not embedded at the beginning of the war, and it was I could drive wherever I wanted and talk to whomever I wanted. By this point, things had become so bad that the only way to go out was to be fully armored, helmet on, goggles on, earplugs in, body armor on, and the rest of it. And so you can imagine, under those conditions, it doesn't exactly lead to an easy conversation with Iraqis. Nonetheless, you know, I tried to bring as many Iraqi voices into the book as I could from people in that section of Baghdad who were working with the soldiers, who were working against the soldiers, and who worked for the soldiers, particularly some of the Iraqi nationals who couldn't find any other work, and so they were working as interpreters for the military. You know, I love this man. There was a man who goes by the name of Izzy. He couldn't use his real name, of course, because of the danger. There's so many stories about Izzy in the book, but to understand Izzy through one detail, he is a guy who in his mind loved the idea of the United States so much that among the few possessions he walked around with was a frequent flyer card from Pan American World Airways, which had been out of business for a decade, I guess, at that point, or slimmed down and almost non-existent. And there was another interpreter who called herself Rachel, mid-20s. Oh, my. She had probably been in 20, 25 explosions at that point, a particular day that I spent with her. And if you ever meet her, she'll be happy to tell you what it's like to try to see a soldier get blown up by a bomb, to be pounding on his chest so hard that her blood or her boots are filling up with his blood. And then afterwards, getting out of the Humvee and apologizing to every soldier in sight because they look at her and think, your people did this to my friend.
Izzy's daughter was wounded at one point and technically speaking had no right to care in a U.S. military facility. Can you talk about that story a little bit?
Yeah. You know, the story also involves a soldier named Brent Cummings, and I'd like to think that if any of us found ourselves in that war, in many ways Brent Cummings is a soldier we would try to be because he had – it's not that the soldiers acted immorally, but – it was so important to him to act morally every day in every way. And one of the examples was he was sitting at dinner one night when his cell phone rang, and it was Izzy calling. And Izzy had a few days off and was with his family in central Baghdad. And a car bomb had gone off, a huge car bomb. I think it killed 100 people. And it wrecked an apartment building, and that was the apartment building where Izzy and his family lived. Izzy was on the phone screaming, help me, help me, help me. My daughter's been injured. The hospitals are so overwhelmed, they won't take her. They said, just her injury is serious. We can't do a thing for her. She was dying as far as Izzy was concerned.
And this is a little girl.
Little girl. And so he called Brent and said, is there any way you can help me? And Brent bent the rules and found a way to get Izzy and his daughter and Izzy's family onto this military base so she could receive help. And the doctors, in fact, removed a huge piece of glass from her head, and she was okay. The thing about Brent Cummings is when we first meet him at the beginning of the deployment and he talks about the importance of acting morally and decently, and by the end of the deployment, because of circumstances, everything just went to complete hell at the end. And the war became so bad and thick and overwhelming. There was one moment when Brent Cummings was watching a video stream of an Iraqi, an insurgent, in a street firing on a convoy of soldiers. And helicopters were being called in to basically take out the guy. And as Brent watched this unfolding, this great moral voice of the war was screaming, die, monkey, die. And he absolutely understood how offensive it was. and how absurd it was. But he needed to say it. And when he did, these other soldiers in that moment began cheering.
They were often surprised by the people back home who had really strong opinions one way or another as to whether the war was right or whether the war was wrong.
It was surprising to everyone when people would come over, the talking heads we see on TV would take what was referred to not only by these soldiers, by all the soldiers, as windshield tours, where you would sort of corkscrew into Baghdad and a very exciting descent into the airport and then get in a Humvee and spend a couple days looking around at the places various generals wanted them to see. And then they would corkscrew out and go home and go on TV and pronounce the surge a success or the surge a failure without any qualification. And these soldiers who were in the middle of the surge would watch this and wonder, how in the world do they know so much about what we're doing when we know less and less every day?
David Finkel is my guest. He's National Enterprise Editor for The Washington Post. His new book is called The Good Soldiers. Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. David Finkel is my guest this hour. We're talking about his new book, The Good Soldiers. We will go next on the line to Ronnie in Fort Worth. Hi, Ronnie.
Hi. Hey, I just want to make a quick comment. I'm retired from the United States Navy myself, and I've got a daughter that is now a sergeant. She's in a military police unit up at Fort Lewis, Washington. She spent 15 months in Baghdad, and there was a couple of stories that she told me about that she called me on the phone and was really upset, and a couple of horror stories. We don't have time to go into now, but, you know, she was telling me that she felt like that it was a waste of time over there, that this thing was, one day would turn on itself and would eat itself because the people that were there, she said it wasn't going to work. Democracy would not work in that country the way we would hope that it would. And, I'm not asking you to betray any of your friends and people that you promised, you know, you keep your opinions or whatever. But I would like to ask you, what do you think your political, what is your political objection to this? And how do you feel about it now as far as the political aspect of the whole thing? And do you think it'll ever get any better over there? How long do you think it'll take to get this thing over with? And basically, I guess that's it. I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I don't feel qualified to pronounce this a success or a failure, and it wasn't my intent in what I did in the name of journalism anyway. I'll talk about what the soldiers thought, if that's okay. You can imagine with 800 soldiers who had been through what they went through, you're going to get 800 different opinions. Some went home thinking they had made a difference. They had accomplished their mission. They had, for the most part, made that section of Baghdad better and safer than what they had found. And plenty of others, because things got so bad at the end, people turning on them, went home really, really disillusioned. And so in some ways, the question doesn't become, to me, the question doesn't become, did it work or did it not work, but what are the lasting effects of this? And that interests me greatly. We have so many soldiers who have been over there and seen, just like what this guy was saying, Ronnie, what you were saying about what your child went through. These were difficult things. And one of the interesting things since the book has come out has been the hundreds of emails I've been getting from soldiers, both in the battalion I wrote about and other battalions. And if there's a general theme, it's I read your book, and the thing is, when I got home, people wanted to, this is paraphrasing the emails and letters. When I got home, everyone wanted to know what it was, did it work? What was it like? And I didn't want to talk to them, and I don't want to talk to them, and I don't want to tell anybody what it's like, and I can't. But now I can give them your book, say, read this thing, and you'll understand why I can't talk about it and why I don't want to. That's not just this battalion. It's there were battalions that had it much worse than the battalion I wrote about, and there are ones that had it much easier. But the fact is, there's an accumulation. There's a certain tension from this war that I don't think has been present in other wars, and everyone to some degree comes home at least a little bit wounded from the experience of being there.
Did you?
You know, I don't think so, but I'm really lucky in a couple of ways. Number one, I feel lucky to have been there to try to document this. I mean that seriously. While I was there, I had the luxury of leaving, taking a break whenever I thought I needed to when my journalism was suffering. When I wasn't doing a good job after a month, month and a half, I could just get out for a few days. I could go to the Washington Post Baghdad Bureau. I could sleep late. I could have a glass of beer. I could just take it easy. Or I could come back to the States and report. The soldiers didn't have that luxury. Every day they were going out into this thing. And at the end of it, I came home and I had 11 months to basically wrestle this thing into some kind of narrative story, to make sense of it, if you will, to tell a story about what happened. That's incredibly cathartic. And the soldiers didn't have that chance. They came home. They had 30 days off. They got assigned to other battalions, perhaps, or they stayed in the 216. Some went back to Afghanistan. Some went back to Iraq. Others simply got out of the army. But they didn't have the chance to contend with it every day to summon that war like I did. So that's a long way of saying I'm fine. I think most of the soldiers are too, but many, many, many aren't.
What kind of respite did they have? What was it, like 15 days throughout the entire tour?
Yeah. It was a little more. You had 18 days of the entire. They were on the ground a little over 14 months in Baghdad, and they got 18 days of leave, and otherwise they were in it.
Did that time, when they would sort of return from that, did they seem refreshed, or was it almost not enough to relax?
The stories I collected from that time, some guys came home and acted quite frantically. Some came home and just picked up life where they had left it before they went and inevitably reached the day where they broke down a little bit and tried to wash some of this out of their system. I thought one of the most interesting home experiences was Ralph Koslarich's, if I can tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things the book tries to do is explain that any war is really two wars. There's the one being fought out of Washington, and there's the one being fought on the ground at the far end. And no day, I think the best illustration was September 4th, 2007. It's the day that George Bush was overheard responding to a question, how's the war going? And his answer was, we're kicking ass. That's his legitimate answer about what the war was on September 4th. To the 216 on September 4th, the answer was another EFP going off into a Humvee, three soldiers dead immediately, a fourth one lost both of his legs, and a fifth one, a 19-year-old named Duncan Crookston, lost both of his legs all the way up, lost all of his right arm, lost most of his left arm, and what was left of Duncan Crookston was pretty much burned. But Duncan didn't die. He was airlifted out and to Texas, to Brooke Army Medical Center. 5 months later, he was still alive. He had undergone 30 surgeries at that point. His ears had fallen off, his nose had fallen off, his eyebrows gone, eyelids, wrapped in bandages still. And there was a day at the end of Ralph Koslarich's 18 days home when he went to see his wounded soldiers, including Duncan Crookston. And he walked into Duncan's room in the burn unit and saw, you know, it didn't make sense. It was just half of a man wrapped in bandages, bolted to a bed, wrapped up entirely, the only skin showing, a little bit on his cheek that was red from burns still, wearing goggles that were self-misting goggles because his eyes could no longer produce moisture. And so there were always droplets inside the goggles. And swimming into his view one day came Ralph Koslarich at the end of his home leave, who stood by Duncan's bed and tried to talk to him. And there was no response from Duncan. Not any movement at all, but Ralph kept talking. Finally, at the end, he said, I'm your commander, and your orders are to get better. Do you hear me? And there was the slightest nod from Duncan, and it was a horrible moment for me anyway, and also for Ralph, because that's when it dawned on him. He knew. He knew everything. He knew what had happened. He knew where he was. He knew what was left of him. He could hear. He knew it all. Kosrush leaves, goes to the airport from Brooke Army Medical Center, flies back to Iraq to continue his deployment, walks into his office, and there is an email waiting for him from Duncan's mother, basically saying that soon after Ralph left, Duncan had died. And I have to say, out of the whole book, I think the most beautiful line in it was written in that email by Duncan's mother. She concluded the email, "Duncan would have been 20 years old tomorrow. He'll be forever 19 now and forever missed."
We will go next on the line to Scott in McKinney. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
My question was related to the idea of triage. I was a Navy medic during the Vietnam era, and military triage teaches keep the most men on the most guns for the longest amount of time, which means you take care of the least wounded first, the more critically wounded last, which is absolutely opposite of what we do in civilian emergency rooms, which is to take care of the most severely injured first and the least injured later. But I'm wondering how that plays out in psychiatric medicine, because those rules are really laid out for physical trauma, and I'm wondering if the same military triage idea is being applied for psychiatric trauma.
It's a really interesting question.
It's a terrific question, and I would like to know the answer myself. I know that at the very upper levels of the Army now, there's a lot more noise being made, and I presume attention being paid to the psychological costs of this war, the increased suicides, the huge number of PTSD cases and traumatic brain injuries and the effects of that. Whether that trickles down to the platoon level in a place that's far from the theaters of Washington, I'm not sure. The anecdotal evidence I saw while I was there in 2007 is it often does not. Sometimes it does. But there was a great mistrust of people who were complaining of psychological trauma. And it's weird because some of the guys, maybe this is obvious to you, but some of the guys who would complain the loudest about how fake this was would seek me out privately and say, I'm in bad shape here. And yet, who were they talking to? They weren't talking to the chaplain. They weren't talking to the mental health guys. They were just talking to a reporter who was taking notes.
Was there ever a point at which you had to say, I'm not the guy? I mean, I want to hear your story, but I'm not the guy who can help you.
Yes. But it was, I think that would have been clear anyway. Mm-hmm. Maybe they just wanted to tell their story and that was enough to get through a day. There was an interesting decision with Kosrush. There's always a great moment in reporting when you stay a place long enough to actually figure out what the story is that you want to write. And it becomes an interesting moment when you can sort of, instead of asking every question in the world of the character you have that you're writing about, you can be asked. You can go harder. You can be specific. You can start kind of boring in a bit. And I never did that with Kosrush because the stakes were so high. A byproduct of questioning sometimes is to introduce some doubt, and I was afraid if I got. I'm not trying to give myself credit here. I just know the process. And if you get someone thinking and ruminating, if I introduce doubt into Kosler just thinking, I was afraid it could have severe and possibly fatal consequences as he carried out his job. So instead, I just watched and watched and watched and watched.
Well, that's a fascinating observation because your job is not to insert yourself into the story. And typically we think about that as sort of not, you know, taking over and driving the vehicle or not, you know, participating in the protest. But in this case, you recognize that your presence could have an effect on someone else's behavior.
In that case. Now, other people, I went as far as I wanted in questioning and conversations. But with Kosrush, I always held back. You know, isn't that something? But I did.
There are some Americans who feel like they don't know quite what to do. They really are appreciative of the troops. You write about a point at which they're receiving little care packages from elementary school kids, and there's cookies and, you know, magazines. And they're grateful for these, but they're saying to themselves, what we really want is better equipment, is armor that works. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think they understood how disconnected. Again, when I talk about two wars, another version of that is these guys, a lot of them felt very, very isolated. I mean, if we're honest about it, there's not conscription anymore, and I'm not advocating a draft,
yeah.
but there's not a broad representation of American society in the military at this point, at least proportionally. There are certain parts of the country that seem to send more soldiers into battle than other parts. And for most Americans, you know, you don't have a son or a daughter or a brother or a sister or even a second cousin in the war. It's just some guys, you know. There's something happening over there, and sometimes it shows up in the newspaper. But it's not like factories were being shut down to manufacture MRAPs to replace Humvees that were getting shredded by these IEDs. There weren't great sacrifices, and the soldiers were aware of that. And, you know, one of the intents of trying to write their story was we might open up the newspaper, and especially now in Afghanistan, and see a headline that says, three soldiers killed by roadside bomb in Afghanistan or in East Baghdad. And you might pause and think, you know, well, that's kind of sad. But there's more to it than that, because the far end of that is the story of Duncan Crookston.
David Finkel is National Enterprise Editor for The Washington Post. His new book is called The Good Soldiers. David, thank you very much for spending the hour with us and for sharing the stories.
Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.